This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Walking is something humans have been doing for almost 2 million years. We evolved our upright posture for very practical reasons, but over the past couple hundred years, walking is a thing people do for fun. It's become a leisure activity. A new book looks at the ways walking became recreational activity and how it influenced society. It's called Walking Histories, 1800 to 1914. And joining me now are two editors and contributors to the book, Chad Bryant, a professor of history at UNC Chapel Hill. Welcome, Chad. Good to talk with you.
Thank you.
Also with us, Paul Redmond, professor of history at King's College London. Hello, Paul.
Hello.
Tell me more about this book, Paul. I'd like to start with you and talk about walking as a topic of academic interest.
Yeah, well, I think walking has really been ignored by historians, or largely ignored by historians, for quite a while. And that's really where we started from. And when we came to conceive this book, actually, we conceived it on a walk in Chapel Hill. I mean, it's too good to be true, isn't it? So we actually were walking in Carborough, actually near Chapel Hill. And where we came up with the idea. But historians have overlooked it, I think probably because it's seen as, you know, such a normal part of everyday existence. It's not something we've studied. Insofar as they have looked at it, scholars have tended to think about people like Wordsworth, great creative types who we know walked a lot. And we know walking was central to their creative activity. We do say a bit about that. Mm-hmm. It's this idea of the romantic walk, developed in the late 18th and early 19th century.
Well, and that, Paul, brings us to the other point. We're not talking about the evolution of walking and how it contributed to who we are today, tool making and all the rest. It really has more to do with, in the last couple of centuries, walking as recreation, right?
That's right, and not just recreation. I mean, the 19th century, in many ways, was the golden age of walking, not because people walked more or walked longer distances, but because the number of practices associated with walking multiplied. So you don't just, you have, for example, the stroll, the hike, which are parts of recreation, but also the commute, the shop, the protest march. And all these things have different valences and different meanings that then help to inform and form part of the modern experience and still do today.
Well, tell us how this happened. I mean, you allow me to think about this in ways that I hadn't before, but walking was a very practical thing. You did it to get from one place to another. But at a certain point, and it was about a couple hundred years ago, am I right, Paul, that it becomes kind of leisure or an activity that is not necessarily as practical as it was.
Yeah, I think, you know, before the late 18th century, walking was just something you did. It was something you did as part of your daily life. It wasn't something maybe you reflect on very much. The one exception to that might be the religious pilgrimage. But then with the expansion of leisure activity, of leisure time, with the expansion of paid holidays and even unpaid holidays, people began to walk for different reasons, sometimes intellectual reasons, sometimes health reasons. So you have this proliferation of recreational forms of walking, the hike, the stroll, the promenade.
Well, but Chad, we think of leisure as sort of having arisen a long time ago. We think of the leisure and the city as something that kind of go hand in hand. So people did have spare time once we started, you know, stopped just hunting and gathering. Why weren't we walking 10,000 years ago when we began to settle into cities? Or why wasn't it the same kind of activity that it is now?
Well, I think it wasn't the same kind of activity in many ways, because there's a class element to it, or a social standing element to it also. Up until the 18th century, the only people who walked outside of cities or between cities were footpads in England, the beggars, the paupers, the people who couldn't afford to have a horse or a carriage. The nobility would never have been caught walking outside of the gardens in which they owned on the estates. But with the rise of the middle class, the middle classes in places like Prague and in England, France, and so forth, sought to mimic both the walk and the garden, but take it in different places. So they created public parks. They created paths outside the city. They created tourist destinations in which walking was central to consuming different sites and so forth. And this along also was bound up with the advent of modern capitalism, which work was delineated to within certain times of the day. That hadn't really been true for the peasant or the farmer or even the guild maker.
I mean, I think that's a very interesting point, Paul. Maybe I'd ask you to talk about that a little bit more, because serfs, you know, in the days of agriculture had plenty of days off. A lot of religious holidays were built in so that they didn't have to toil in the farms. But the last thing they had in mind was walking to the next village, right?
Yeah, I think people had fairly constrained sort of, their lives were lived very locally. I mean, I think walking was still important in these sort of contexts, but it might have been more like the walk to church than the right. recreational walk. You do get in rural areas so the idea of the Sunday stroll becomes something that even ordinary working people are starting to do in the 19th century. In our book, actually, one of the chapters on 19th century Hungary talks about how ordinary peasants in 19th century Hungary used the act of walking around the boundaries of their local communities to kind of inscribe a sense of community, to give meaning to the place in which they live. So through the acts of walking, they found meaning in their immediate locale.
Walking also as an act of protest. Tell us more about that.
Absolutely. I mean, it's not until the early 19th century, really, or the late 18th century, that walking becomes something you do as a means of protest, as a means of asserting, you know, your right to be in a particular civic space.
How did that look? What are some examples of that?
Well, one example for the British mid-19th century example would be Chartists. So the Chartists is a working class organisation, very large movement, really, demanding political reform, demanding the reform of the franchise, demanding the vote for working people. And a lot of their protest took the form of walking, organised processions leading to what they called monster demonstrations, often on common land. So in actually walking through the city, walking past the houses of the rich, the people who had the vote, they were saying, look, we're part of this polity, we're part of this urban space.
So not only did they, in a sense, occupy the space and move through it, but also could show your numbers as well.
For sure, for sure. It becomes a spectacle. And you get it with women's suffrage organizations as well. So women beginning to campaign for the vote through the act of walking.
Chad, you mentioned Prague in particular. How was Prague distinct, or was it, from other European cities in the way it contributed to how we understand walking?
Well, it was distinct from many cities in the western part of Europe because it was smaller. It was, you know, 100,000 people in 1846, and it was a relatively provincial city. My Czech friends will probably be upset about hearing, but it was a relatively provincial city in the early 19th century. So in some ways, it mimicked some of the practices that we see, the rise of this middle class. It was composed in Prague of traders, members of the rising intelligentsia, civil servants, and so forth. But one thing that distinguished Prague was that Prague is surrounded on three sides by hills. And so strollers sort of made these hills one of the objects of their walks. And in doing so, helped to make the panorama. So one of the goals of walking. I mean, this was happening throughout Europe, but it was especially true in Prague. And also they went on walks that celebrated the ways in which nature and the urban could mix. And this was against what many people had been saying about walking beforehand, who had seen walking as an escape from the city, an escape into nature, should be done alone, and was seen as anti-modern. But this was actually something that mixed the modern and the romantic very nicely in some ways. And many tourists from Germany came here for that very reason to Prague.
But it also suggests, Paul, the rise of our sense of nature as the other. So we're sort of separating ourselves even more as seeing nature as the place you go when you're not working.
Yeah, the 19th century is the great age of urbanism. It's the great age where populations begin to concentrate more and more in cities. I mean, in Britain, 50% of the population lives in urban areas in the middle of the century. By the end of the century, it's down to about 20%. So that has a real impact. And then that urbanizing process causes people to see nature and access to nature is increasingly important for their own development, not just as individuals. And so you get the rise of things like rambling organizations in many industrial centers, and ordinary people beginning to find solace in the countryside and walking through nature. And someone I'm quite interested in is James Bryce, who actually is very supportive. He's a British aristocrat. He's not a British aristocrat, British politician, Viscount Bryce. But he's actually a great supporter of the American National Parks movement. And it's through his walking that he sees that sort of movement is so important.
And that brings us to maybe the distinction between the walk and the hike, the idea that you're going to walk out of your house and through the town and maybe around the town to the hills. When does it change, or when do we start seeing the rise of the sort of the hike as a destination, getting to the trailhead?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's part of a panoply of of various practices that emerged in the early 19th century. So for example, in England, but also throughout the European continent, there were many amateur botanists who didn't have necessarily a destination. That's a very tourist idea to have a destination. But their goal was to walk in throughout the countryside and look at flowers. Or amateur geologists who went through when the trains went through, were cut through various mountains, they exposed rocks and fossils that people went out to see.
Or mountaineers, for example. I mean, the early mountaineers, we think now people mountaineer, you know, climb mountains or walk up mountains for fun, for recreation. But early mountaineers often combined their mountain walking with geology or meteorology or something like that. And it's only later it becomes a kind of recreational activity.
So we think it's an obvious connection to the natural sciences, but also the humanities. I mean, this was important too, and it changed music, philosophy. I mean, figures like Nietzsche and Beethoven enjoyed walking very much, right?
Yeah, famously Nietzsche said that all great ideas come from walking. I mean, that's how he did his philosophy, in the open air on foot. And it's also true of Kant. It's also true of the Danish philosopher Kierkegaard, for example, who, you know, walked around the centre of Copenhagen every day at a certain time and came back so full of philosophical ideas. He'd go into his study, he'd still have his hat on, he'd still have his coat on, he'd still be holding his umbrella in one hand, and immediately he'd write down the ideas he'd come up with while on his walk. So that's quite important, I think. And it's partly, the romantic walk in that sense still persists. And it was very important for people like Dickens, for whom walking into London in the 19th century was a means of getting what he sought, what he called pictures to support his ideas and that he could build into his prose. So it is really important. Yeah, walking has been a great stimulus to creative activity and still is.
That's a romantic idea that we might hold about all philosophers, musicians, artists, that somehow strolling and walking. So I wonder to what extent that is new in over the past 200 years, or whether that has always been part of the inspiration, which is sort of getting your blood going for artists and philosophers. Do we know? Does it? Oh, and the other question, the other side of that question is, did it have much of an impact on the way they saw the world? The fact that now there are these strollers out there with them, and that this is a new activity. What influence does that have on music, art, philosophy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we didn't really investigate the intellectuals in the 17th and 16th century, so I can't say anything definitive. But my guess would be that it wasn't as prevalent in many ways, because walking simply wasn't safe for many people before the 18th century. Outside the city walls, you're open to robbers and vagabonds and various sorts. And within the city walls, or within the city itself, the sidewalk didn't emerge until the 18th century. The lighting of the streets didn't emerge until the 19th century in most places. No one would have ever dared walk at night. And of course, women almost never walked the streets or walked, you know, outside of their homes alone or by themselves as well, for reasons of safety often. So the technologies of not just urban design but also transport and the creation of safe roads and the police state allowed for walking. And this is one reason why the nobility walked in their gardens. It was safe. It was within the what we now call the compounds or the estates of their lives.
You were about to say something.
No.
Well, I wondered about about that as well, the idea that we know that the elites, right, the aristocrats have these beautiful gardens and they stroll. To what extent the middle class said, well, we can do that too, once we're starting to sort of, you know, show our power, that this is a way of mimicking class and power.
Mm-hmm. No, that's
getting
true.
Out to walk.
And I think also that, but they mimicked, but they also transformed. So, for example, in the 18th century, the classic garden was the French garden, or the Baroque garden, as it was known in Central Europe, something that looked like you see at Versailles, you know, straight lines, symmetrical, long views, and so forth. But beginning in the 18th century, the rising middle classes embraced what they call the English garden, which we now think of the same as the botanical garden on campus, this meandering paths through nature, and also interesting, like, things to see and talk about. So often people wouldn't. This was the origins of the garden gnome, was actually in the first part of the 19th century. Things like garden gnomes, Chinese pagodas, things that gave you something to talk about, as well as memorabilia from the owner's family or the state monuments were now in the gardens as well. Mm-hmm. They became points of conversation around middle class life and in public spaces.
Paradoxically, the garden gnomes don't walk.
No, they don't.
They do in the commercials.
But they do look at you suspiciously.
Golf, you have to, because golf is the game, of course, that Mark Twain described as a good walk spoiled.
Yeah.
And you have the, I mean, that's also kind of an important or an interesting, I guess, part of the story.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, historians haven't really thought about golf as something that's involved walking, but it is a way that people got to know landscape and actually walked the country, if you like. And particularly important for women, I think, golf. It becomes something that women do nearly as much as men by the end of the 19th, early 20th century. So, yeah, I mean, we were seeking in the book, I suppose, to show the different ways in which walking entered into different practices. And if we put walking at the centre of our analysis, we can explain a lot of different things. For example, the world of children. So children in Melbourne, in Australia, that's one of our chapters in the book by Simon Slight. And Simon shows how children actually roved quite freely around their city in the 19th century, really quite far from their homes. So we get a sense, through looking at the walking practices of children, how their world was constructed. So if we put walking at the centre of analysis, we find out a lot about children, about class, about women, about protest. You know, it's central to so many different things.
Fascinating stuff. Have we left the golden age of walking? Are we busy twiddling our thumbs, literally, on our smartphones and not walking as much?
Yeah, well, that's actually what Lillard has been about walking. It usually ends with the car as the end of the golden age of walking. But I think there is hope, I think, for walking, not just because we can't always be looking at our phones and so forth, but a lot of the new urbanism, the new design within the cities and suburbs, you know, emphasizes the walkability, the ability to walk to your local grocery store, the movie theater, or ideally walk to a train to get to work. This is more and more becoming something that's desirable among homeowners, but also city planners and living in cities more generally.
Fascinating stuff. I want to thank you both for being on the program, Chad Bryant and Paul Redmond. Chad, a professor of history at UNC Chapel Hill. Paul, a professor of history at King's College in London. Thank you both for being on the program.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
They are editors and contributors of a new book, Walking Histories, 1800 to 1914, and they're going to give a talk, and we have that information at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton Ormond, and Katie Barron. Robin Copley is our technical director, Brent Wolf, WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.